This week on Basic, John Stewart.
I had a very particular idea of what I would want to do with it because I'd done so many things where I was sort of playing to the structure of, oh, it's a talk show on MTV. I will design that. But it wasn't what I wanted. I accepted the job and I came up and I had a meeting there. So I walked into the room and the first thing, there's a guy in the back, one of the writers, and he goes, just to let you know, we're not doing some MTV bullshit here. This is a real show. And I go, what? You know, we're not doing music. This is no bullshit. And I was like, I don't know if you've been told like what my idea was for, you know, where I wanted to take things. But it wasn't so much almost what they were saying. It was the hostility with which they were saying it. And then I came home from the meeting and I called James and I said, get me out of this.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to Basic, the official podcast of the unofficial history of cable television. I'm Doug Herzog, a former TV executive, and if you're a Daily Show fan, this is definitely your moment of zen.
And I'm Jen Chaney, TV critic for Vulture and New York Magazine, and this is The Daily Show. Actually, it's a podcast about The Daily Show.
Well, Jen, as you mentioned, we got a pretty special guest to kick off season three of Basic, and it's part one of a conversation with my old colleague and friend, John Stewart.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited, Doug, and also a little bit nervous. The Daily Show under John was one of the most important shows in modern cable television history. It was smart, it was funny, it was award-winning, and it was groundbreaking. I think it changed late-night comedy and even the way we view and absorb the news. But we're also going to hear about John's career before he landed that great gig.
That's right. I know John a pretty long time, so long I can remember when he still smoked cigarettes and ate red meat. So we're going to dig a little deep here into his roots on episode one. We'll talk about his time at MTV and something called the Comedy Channel, and we'll take it from there.
And don't forget, this is actually part one of a two-part conversation. We'll be back next week with part two. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the first half of our discussion with John Stewart. And as always, Doug and I will close out the show with some of our reflections on that discussion.
Hey, it's John Stewart, and welcome to Basic. How you doing, man?
Wait, welcome to what?
To Basic. That's the name of the show.
Oh, I didn't know that. I thought it was like the Doug and Jen show. It's called The Basic?
It's called
it's just
Basic.
With an exclamation point. Huh? The exclamation point is important, I think.
Yeah.
So it's not Basic. It's Basic!
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Right. Like, as in basic cable.
Right. Oh.
See what I did
Doug,
there?
You're so far. Fuck. You're so far ahead of me on this. It's unbelievable. Basic cable. That's what we did. We worked
that's
together.
That's what we did. Yeah. That's basic cable. That's how we know each other.
That is how we know each other.
Speaking of which.
Yes.
We asked this question is our traditional first question we ask to every guest, which is, do you remember when you first saw cable television?
Sure.
Tell us.
Yeah, it was pretty high. As most of us were back then. And I don't think I remember the first time I saw basic cable. I remember the first time I saw MTV.
No.
Because I don't think basic cable.
Same thing, kind of.
Synonymous at a
synonymous,
certain point.
Yeah,
but I would imagine I clicked on to, you know, the Weather Channel or A&E at some point and didn't quite register like, this Hitler documentary is very different. I'm receiving it in a different way. But I do remember MTV being wildly different and seeing that in a, you know, I'd moved off campus and we were pretty high and I think Duran came on or some shit. And the whole world opened up, Douglas, the whole world.
Well, you just said two trigger words for my co-host. Yes. One was talking about your college and the second one was talking about Duran. So I'll let Jen take it from here.
Yes,
I was hungry
you.
Like the wolf, Jen. Hungry.
I still am. I still am. So you referred to your campus. You went to the best college in the country, William & Mary, as did I.
And did you really go there? When did you out?
94, so 10 years behind you.
I just missed you.
Just a little.
Just a decade.
Obviously, you played soccer there. I believe your major was psychology. Is that right?
Jen, I'm getting very uncomfortable right now.
Why? You think I'm stalking you?
You know too much.
It's called doing your research.
That was. I have a psychology degree and I played soccer.
Were you politically engaged at all at that point in your life, like paying attention to the news, or was that something that you didn't really think about until later?
No. I mean, you know, it was obviously a very different world. I mean, between social media and the kind of information, people were not engaged to the extent that they're engaged now, as in the relentlessness of engagement. But for, I'd say, the general obliviousness of the decade, remember, this was early Reagan, the me decade, or just past the me decade, I thought, relatively engaged based on the context of the times.
Okay.
This was 60s, everybody was engaged. 70s, everybody started to tune out. Cocaine came into the picture. And then in the 80s, it was all Gordon Gekko and nobody gave a shit about anything. And let's move on. So in that era and in that context, I think I was relatively engaged.
So you roll out of, whoops, sorry.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
No, follow up.
Jen, I wanted to point out that Doug has no on-camera experience, and so he's going to continue to do these types of things, Jen.
Interrupt me? Oh, it happens constantly.
Lack of professionalism. And you can see from basically you've been placed in, I think, a beautiful room with a fireplace. Doug has been relegated to, I believe, where the janitor keeps all of the things he sells on eBay. So you can see there's a difference in terms of status and talent.
Right. Well, I try not to bring that to his attention too much, you know, trying to keep the power dynamics even.
I think that's wise.
No, I was just going to ask, like, were you at that time, were you a Democrat? Were you a Republican? Were you not affiliated with a party? Like, did you align yourself in any way?
Affiliation, I don't think was as, you know, again, I probably, you know, I didn't think as much about it, but I would almost... The entirety of the Republican Party at that time was, I think, more moral majority. Like that was the general energy flow that went through there. So, yeah, I was the antithesis of all that, that sort of new conservatism. So, yeah, no, the Reagan years, all those things, I probably, yeah, wanted no part of it.
And then you ended up on stage in comedy clubs. So what was that journey? So you graduate school, was stand-up and comedy, was that what you decided to do when you left school?
No. I decided to bartend. I went back to... I lived in Trenton, New Jersey with a couple of friends of mine in a house that was quite drafty, if I'm being honest, but like $200 a month. So, and I bartended at this crazy, incredibly legendary punk club called City Gardens.
Yeah, cool place.
In Trenton, New Jersey, on Calhoun Street. And it was... fucking fantastic. And I did that for a couple of years. And then on a bit of a whim or an impulse, I sold all my shit and moved to New York and had a 6-week lease. I knew where I was going to live for 6 weeks. I didn't have a job, but I knew that, you know, I knew that once I got out of school and I was like, I was working at that club and I was working at this bar called the Bottom Half underneath a liquor store on Route 1 in New Jersey. And I remember thinking like, so this is it. And when I got to that punk club, I was like, nope, world's filled with possibilities, filled with interesting people doing interesting shit. And it inspired me to kind of take a little more agency in the life I was going to live and move to New York City and just thought I'd try writing and stand up and whatever other shit I could get my hands on.
And I mean, did you... have thoughts about going into comedy before, like when you were younger, or was this something that just kind of hit you once you got out of college?
I mean, I don't come from showbiz people. And as you guys know, like the world was just different then. You weren't exposed to the kinds of things, but yeah, like I used to watch Carlin and Steve Martin and all those guys and think like, I think my brain works in a similarly eccentric fashion as that. That may be something that may be a place. Because I always felt very disassociated from the general pathways that people were supposed to go. I just never felt like my brain clicked into any of those tracks. And the first time I went to a comedy club, that was definitely when it clicked in. When I sat down and I watched people and I thought, that's exactly how I think. I got to do that.
So you started plying your trade late at night at comedy clubs in Manhattan, right? And at some point, you catch the attention of a very early version of Comedy Central, and you were tapped to co-host a show or host a show called Short Attention. This is before my time there, called Short Attention Span Theater.
No, you know what it was? It was, so Comedy Central at that point was not Comedy Central. It was Comedy Channel.
It was still the Comedy Channel, the HBO version.
And then there was another one called Ha that was, and I can't remember who ran that one, but somebody owned, Time Warner owned one. Somebody owned.
Viacom ran Ha.
Oh, is that what that was? Okay. So
Yeah. It was Viacom. It was MTV and HBO. Yeah.
And a buddy of mine who was a comic was working. And you know, the timeline and all this shit is so confusing to me, but so he was producing a show called The Rachel Sweet Show for
former pop star,
Comedy Channel, former pop star, lovely person, very smart, mm-hmm. very funny.
Still as a comedy writer, writes on sitcoms out here in Hollywood.
Yes, yes.
Worked on it. Yeah. I've worked with her.
She was lovely. So he got a gig, you know, back then we were all schmucks. Everybody was just banging around working for 15 bucks a night, 50 bucks on the weekend. He got a job, one of the first people that I knew who got like a real opportunity out in Los Angeles. And I think he got a job as a staff writer on Murphy Brown. His name is, you may remember it, Michael Patrick King.
Yes.
He was a stand-up and was
wow
a friend of mine. And so he had gotten the job producing on Rachel Sweet. He was going to be moving to LA to do Murphy Brown, I believe. And he asked me if I would like to be a writer on that show. And so that was my first like job in other than banging around the clubs and trying to, you know, do the one nighters in Jersey and, you know, the Roger Paul gigs where you're at a Fuddruckers in upstate New York. regular gig, like, you know, basic cable, as we all remember the business model, $400 a week. Basic cable, it's not a profitable business. We can't pay you more than what you might make, let's say, at a malt shop. I got a gig writing for Rachel Sweet, and 6 weeks later, the show was canceled. And there was some finger pointing my way. Everything was fine until you showed up there. But there was a guy there, I think, who, you know, I caught their eye doing something or other. And so when Short Attention Span Theater came up, I got called to audition and ended up getting that. And that was probably 91 or 92, something along those lines.
And then you're on TV.
Not really. I was on Comedy. I was on in like, I think the distribution at that time was like some survivalist camps in Montana. Like it was, you know, you got it on satellite. And I think the, you know, the distribution was probably 7 million homes, 10 million homes, something crazy. You know, but it that was the beginnings of it. And then, and then ultimately I think they merged with Ha.
Right. So, the Comedy Channel, the cable operators said to HBO and MTV, look, we don't want two comedy channels. They both kind of suck, by the way. Why don't you guys figure it out and get back to us? And they decided to merge and create Comedy Central.
That's right. But Comedy Channel had like, they were doing shit. Like they had built a little studio.
Alan Havey and Rachel Sweet and John Stewart.
Tommy Sledge, Higgins Boys and Gruber. But it all took place in this little studio on 23rd Street on the east side. And so it was a very communal, like all the shows taped out of this one sort of Lazy Susan studio of little sets. There was like five little sets. Havey was the late night show. Higgins Boys and Gruber was kind of the sketch show. Tommy Sledge was just this, he was like this character. He was a stand-up whose persona was an old 40s detective. So all his jokes had, you know, walking sticks and all that kind of lingo. And it was all just kind of this little community.
They were trying to do like the MTV of comedy.
That's correct.
Yeah. And they got that part right.
Yeah, no question. And so that's where it was all going on. It was really fun and exciting, and it was a great time to be over there. And I worked with a comedian named Patty Rossborough, who was just so fun and such a lovely person. And we had a blast introducing, at that time, what they were doing is they were just cannibalizing stand-up. So they would take these stand-up clips and we would be VJs to the stand-up as opposed to VJs for the music. And that was it. That was the business model, man. And then years later, two guys from Colorado made a cartoon called South Park, and the rest is history.
We'll get to that.
Oh, we're gonna walk through the whole fucking thing. How long are we gonna be here?
As long as it takes.
As long as it takes. Exactly.
All right. Let me jump ahead.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus meal plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
So let's jump into MTV, which was a couple years later, right?
Yeah, did short attention span theater for about a year. And then Patty had a kid. And I mean, this is back in the old days when they were like, yeah, you're not coming back. And I was like, if she's not coming back, I'm not coming back. You know, like thinking like they'd be like, oh, okay, we'll have her back. And they were like, okay, that's fine. You're all fucking disposable as far as we're concerned. So I left too. And that was, you know, I don't know.
Early 90s,
probably. Yeah, yeah. And then a woman by the name of, you know her well, Eileen Katz, asked me if there was anything that I wanted to do at MTV. And I was like, of course. I remember having a big meeting. I had a big meeting at MTV and they wanted me to pitch a couple ideas. And I was like, I got this. And the first was like, what if we did the real world in space? You know, some ridiculous, like, what if we get a space station and did the real world and did that? And, you know, I could just tell that the glazed over look at the meeting. And then I was like, or a talk show. And they were like, yeah, let's do that.
Well, wait, you're missing a chapter though.
Well, no, Eileen hired me to do a show called You Wrote It, You Watch It, which was the original MTV. Basically, the idea was people would write stories that they had experienced or dreams or whatever. And there was this incredibly talented young sketch group called State. And they would act it out, these letters, along with some other cast members. And I would just wander around the meatpacking district taping wraparounds because everything at MTV was very hip back then. And they were all like, Dennis Leary's hot right now. Why don't we all stand in front of graffiti and see what we can do with it? So we all went down there in black leather jackets and stood in front of graffiti and smoked and went, coming up next. And that was, what are you watching?
We had Carrie Kinney and Tom Lennon on the podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
What was your relationship like with those guys from the State?
Because I love those guys.
Apparently they drove Mike Judge crazy.
They were chaos.
In the MTV offices.
Yeah, but I love that. They were chaos agents. But I love that. I think, as a matter of fact, I think on the last episode of our talk show, I invited the State on with chainsaws, and we just destroyed the set.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's right. Right. I forgot about that.
But they were so talented and so, like, young. I mean, I think they were
right out of NYU, literally.
They might have still be in college. Yeah, they're...
One or two might have still been in college when we first started. Yeah, yeah, they were very young.
But just hilarious. And there was a million of them.
And, so they were... and by the way, not 9 out of 11 went on to, like, they're still working today. It's amazing.
9/11.
Oh God, a conspiracy.
Interesting numerology. Interesting. I wonder what the Saudis would have to say about this.
So then you do what really I think you know, kind of brought you to much wider attention, which was the Jon Stewart Show. Your
That's right. That was the
your very first own show and a talk show, right?
I had this idea. What if I told a few jokes and then interviewed celebrities about projects they're working on? And then after that, short interview, we would hear music from a hot band, like a song, and that would be it. That would be the show. Some jokes, interview, and a music.
No one had ever done it.
I got to tell you, Doug, it went like hotcakes. I mean, people were like, and they have a clip of the project they're talking about? Oh, this is something I've not seen this before. No, I think we did a talk show, and the big difference was like I sat on car seats. Like, you know, it was MTV, so you couldn't do it. I did a talk show, but at a Dutch angle. And they were like, okay.
In a leather jacket.
In a leather jacket on a Dutch angle. And people are like, I've never seen anything like this. Brilliant.
Also, I mean, no one had ever seen a white guy do it either. That was what was so groundbreaking.
And a Jewish guy. I mean, to boot. I was breaking ceilings. I couldn't even see any. There was just glass falling all over the place. Phenomenal. But they let me do whatever I wanted. And we had a ball. I mean, it was a ball.
Ran on MTV for like a year or two, and then went to sin. When we decided we could no longer afford it, it went into syndication with our sister company, Paramount.
Well, you know what happened? Arsenio left.
That's
he
right.
He retired. And I was at MTV, and I guess Paramount, which had produced Arsenio, decided, you know what would be the most organic transition in the history of talk shows? If we went from Arsenio to this guy. Because the audience is such a natural fit. And
That was a different experience of working for MTV, in the world of syndication. Right?
Oh man. I remember, I think we were probably three shows in, and I had this great idea. I was gonna have Dave Attell come on. Dave was writing on the show, and everybody knows Dave's comedy is fucking hilarious. I had this big idea that one of my guests that night was going to be Adolf Hitler. We were going to have Dave Attell come on. Nobody knew what Hitler had been up to. We were going to have Hitler come on, and he was going to talk about what he was working on. And we brought a clip. As you can imagine, the audience did not realize how arch and meta we were and how clever we were. And so I said, our next guest, you haven't heard from him in a while. He is one of the most notorious villains in history. Ladies and gentlemen, Adolf Hitler. Attell comes out, is Adolf Hitler, completely dressed in Nazi paraphernalia, holding a bagel with cream cheese. And the crowd, as you would imagine, booed like it was Elon Musk at a Dave Chappelle show. And we did a whole, I think Dave's first line was, these are delicious. I don't know what I was so afraid of with these people. You know, the thing just went off the rails from there. And not even at the end of the show, in the commercial break, the red phone that we didn't even know was plugged in started to ring. And, you know, then everybody was running around and it was a fire drill. And John, you need to go to the control room. Beth McCarthy, who we all know and love.
The great Beth McCarthy, director.
Best director of all things live and otherwise, was in the control room. Just his look on his face because she was hearing the conversation behind her. And I came in, picked up the phone, and they said, we will never air this show and you will never do that again. And so I think four shows into our run, we aired a repeat of the show.
Oh, wow. Off to a blazing start.
Blazing start. And it just went uphill from there. Yeah.
How did no one know what you were going to do beforehand?
Because they were in Los Angeles and we were in New York. And Generally, the pace of what you do, they don't expect you to be an idiot. You know, they're not expecting that you're going to. So they weren't necessarily. It's a little trick I learned and I used it to great effect at Comedy Central, which Doug will tell you, which is volume. If you put a fire hose of content on them, at a certain point, they're just going to be like, sure, it's fine. Nobody wants to work that much. And so it got out there and it went. I mean, it's a show that began with Dave Attell dressed as Hitler and ended with giant condors sitting on an audience member's neck, pecking at them, with the audience shouting, "Sue them, sue them."
Are there things that you take from that experience and also your experience at MTV that helped inform what you did ultimately at The Daily Show?
Yeah. If you're going to use birds of prey, even if they're, scavengers, you just got to make sure they're fed beforehand. Because to their mind, what you may see is, a lovely couple from Poughkeepsie who are just in town to see a show, they might look at as dinner. So you have to be very careful. Got to feed the condors. Let me say this, and this is for anybody who's listening, and you got to feed the condors. You got to feed them beforehand.
It's true.
Yeah.
Actually, I have an important question. Do you remember when you first met Doug and what your impression of Doug was?
So I first met Doug.
Leave corduroys out of it, John.
Well, then I can't. Then I can't tell the story.
Go ahead. Have at it.
Down in Florida. And it's MTV Spring Break. And MTV Spring Break is the first legalized Bacchanal ever to be shown on standard cable television. This is back when rules don't matter. And, basically cable stations were encouraging, let's say, irresponsible sex. They were encouraging people who were younger than the age of drinking to not only do that, but to also randomly hook up with other people of the same age and inebriation level. And I'm already 29 or almost 30 years old, and I'm down there partnered with like the Wheez. So you got one guy.
also a podcast guest.
Come
one
up.
Guy running around Daytona Beach going like, and I'm over there like, I have a terrible lactose issue. I'm going to go up to the hotel. So we're at a Stone Temple Pilots concert on the beach in Daytona.
One of the greatest lineups of all time.
Oh, of all time. What was do you remember the whole lineup?
Yeah. It was Stone Temple Pilots, Living Color,
yes,
Soul Asylum,
yes,
Lenny Kravitz, The Black Crowes. How 90s is that?
Oh, God.
I was going to say, this is the most 90s conversation I've had in a long time.
Yeah.
So it's jamming. And the whole time I'm there at the concert, I'm rocking, but I'm also hearing like, it almost feels like feedback or static. And I'm like, this is like, I've worked in punk clubs. I'm like, am I getting the Peter Townsend thing? Did I blow an eardrum? Well, it wasn't any of those things. What it was the perpetual motion machine that was Doug Herzog wearing a pair of brown corduroys. And like a cricket, when he would rub his legs together and in Living Color and all the other bands, you would just hear bopping up and down.
Corduroy, of course, that's what you wear to spring break.
And that was my introduction to the great Doug Herzog.
I remember when I first met, I didn't meet John, but I saw John came to a game show run through that Eileen was doing for some bad game show.
Yeah.
In an MTV conference room. And you were a judge.
Was that the Yahoo Serious game? Or no, I did warm up for that or something.
It could have been. And I don't think it was Yahoo.
They hired Yahoo Serious to host the game show. The Australian comedian.
Yeah, I do remember Yahoo Serious, that Australian guy. Oh my God, so unfunny. Anyway, you were a judge and you were really funny. You had a comment on stuff and we left the run through and Eileen said, "What did you think of the game show?" I said, "The game show was terrible, but the guy in the leather jacket and the Mets hat was really funny." and she goes, "That's Jon Stewart. I've been telling
Here's
you about
Here's what's sad. It. I dressed the exact same way." And that's how it all happened. But yeah.
So the Jon Stewart show goes down in syndication flames. You did your like lost years out in L.A.
Never moved out to L.A.
Never actually lived here.
No.
Oh, I thought you lived here. You're just going back and forth.
I did my lost years in a illegal sublet in New York.
Ah.
I went out to L.A. at 2 week pops. Even when I did Sanders, I did Larry Sanders for 2 years.
Right.
And even writing and performing on that, I never moved there.
Ah.
I would only go out there for 2 to 3 weeks at a pop, and I would live in a little hotel. You remember those old hotels that were every room's a suite, but what it really was just a studio with like that really long carpet and then two stairs.
Right.
And then you would step up the stairs. I can't remember. It might have been the Bellage.
Oh, nice.
And I would just live there for 3 weeks and
then come back.
Commute over to Radford and do that and come back. But I would never move there.
So you were doing Sanders. You did a couple of movies. Mixed Nuts. That's Let's not forget Mixed Nuts. Great Christmas soundtrack, by the way. And but you were.
Absolutely. Eight weeks in a trailer on the beach in
with Steve Martin
in Santa Monica with the greatest cast in the history of terrible
and
movies.
you were still, though, kind of considered the heir apparent to Letterman. Everybody always talked about you, maybe one day, at least at that time, you know, replacing Letterman. Was that a job that you ever really wanted?
No. I mean, it's a huge job, but that all happened before MTV. The MTV talk show was. So all of that was born of stand-up. And so if you remember when Dave left, at that time, the job that Conan got was the one that when Dave was leaving late night, the 12:30 slot, that was, we were all, I mean, look, Dave was and is everybody's sort of idol at that time. You know, I'd been fortunate enough to be on the show a bunch and had a pretty good, you know, rapport with him. And then I think what happened was Lorne was going to produce it. And so he did a series of auditions to see. And I remember, you know, and that was back in the days, like you'd audition for something. And then like, if you got lucky enough, they'd fly you out. And we got flown out to do a night at the Improv on Santa Monica. And it was going to be all the folks that were up for it, which is such a
You're all there,
beautifully comfortable recipe for camaraderie. We were all there. It was myself and might have been Stilson, Drew Carey, and Paul Provenza, a bunch of us, and we all just performed
for Lorne.
That's right, at the Santa Monica Improv, and the only guy who wasn't there was Conan.
The fix was in.
Not the fix. Just like, none of us, I guess, particularly wore well that night. That was all before MTV talk show. So once I did the MTV talk show and then the Paramount thing, like I knew that was like not that I wanted to write or do stand up or other things.
So then obviously you changed your tune when the Daily Show possibility came around. What made you want to go
Doug?
Back to doing that.
Doug changed my.
What's that?
Doug changed my.
Oh, tell me more.
No, well, I, you know, we actually heard a story. We had Madeline and Liz on. They sort of did the origin story of the Daily Show, and one of the things that Madeline said was when she called you to get your advice about. Going maybe with Kilbourne over to CBS. This is after Kilbourne says he's leaving.
She called you
for advice, and you gave her some great advice, one of which was to stay with The Daily Show if you really loved it. But she said that you later said that conversation about The Daily Show was when you kind of decided maybe this was something for you. Is that true?
Well, it was one of those things where I had a very particular idea of what I would want to do with it was more... And the question was, is that something that you guys would be interested in more than it was anything else? Because I'd done so many things where I was sort of playing to the structure of, it's a talk show on MTV. I will design that. But it wasn't what I wanted. And so this was a vehicle that I thought, this has the opportunity to become the thing that would be the most direct extension of me creatively that I could think of. But the question was, is that what you guys wanted? And that's where that lunch that we all had kind of was the impetus for the decision was if you guys were interested in that vision of it more than, because I knew it was, you know, obviously a great vehicle with really smart, funny people attached to it.
Yeah. And it was, I mean, to be honest, I think, you know, we were, you know, certainly Madeline, myself and Eileen, the people who were running, you know, the show in Comedy Central at that point, we were just huge fans. And so I think you could have told us you were going to have a tell on eating bagels dressed as Hitler every day. And we would have said, and we would have said, yes.
Are you serious? I thought I was persuasive that day.
You were, well, we couldn't believe you were interested. You saw something clearly in the show that, you know, that had yet to be explored or be seen by anybody who was involved with it. And you know, that's the whole story there. But you know, we were like, oh my God, John wants to do the show. Let's do the show with John and see what happens. Yeah,
that's hilarious. And then I came and I accepted the job, and I came up and I had a meeting there before I took go. It was after Kilbourne had left, I think.
Kilbourne announced he was leaving, but didn't leave till the end of the year.
That's right. I had a meeting up there with all the writers. And then I came home from the meeting and I called James and I said, get me out of this. I don't know if you remember that. I don't know if you remember James calling you at that point and saying.
I remember.
Who is James?
James Dixon.
Baby Doll Dixon.
He constantly comes up in these conversations, constantly.
Because he's everywhere. He is the air that we breathe.
He works not only with John, but with Stephen Colbert, yes. Jimmy Kimmel, Bill Simmons, right. and a host of us.
Yes. And he and I have been working together since like 1988.
Yes.
Schmucks.
Why did you want to get out of it?
Oh, because I thought the people were insane. I thought they were totally fucking insane and like assholes. Like, I couldn't believe it. I remember we went to the meeting and I go in there and this is the environment, but I had no idea. Like, this was the, like, for me, just like blindsided by the whole, like, I didn't realize all the complicated politics of this place. Liz had just gotten into a terrible situation with the previous host where he had said like horrible things about her to a magazine. And then he got like, but I didn't. So I walked into the room, and this is after like it'd been announced and all that shit. We sat down, and the first thing, there's a guy in the back, one of the writers, and he goes, just to let you know, we're not doing some MTV bullshit here. This is a real show. And I go, what? And from there, you're not going to change shit. You know, we're not doing music. This is no bullshit. And I was like, I don't know if you've been told like what my idea was for, you know, where I wanted to take things, but that's not it. But it wasn't so much almost what they were saying. It was the hostility with which they were saying it that I was like, oh, this is going to be,
there was some toxicity back then in that room.
This is going to be bad.
Yeah.
I can remember there was a dude, who was the dude, the correspondent, Brian Unger. Brian Unger leaves the show and in his exit interview to the press, says, why did you leave? And he goes, I wanted to leave while I could still be proud of what we did.
That hasn't aged well.
And I'm reading this shit and I'm like, what am I getting myself into? So I immediately called James and I go, you got to get me out of this because I can't, like, this is crazy.
Right.
You know, I'd worked with Stabs before. I'd worked on the most like dysfunctional place in the world, which was the Sanders Show. But when I walked into that room, I was like, this is going to be,
yeah. Okay. Well, the dynamic of the show before you got there was it was kind of a producer and writer led show, right? Craig was more the vessel that everything went through, and you came in with an actual.
That's right. Well, he played a character.
He was like close to home, but a character. with all due respect to Craig, I mean, he'd probably tell you the same thing.
I understand. Listen, when I first walked into the office, there were a lot of mirrors in it. That was first thing I did was like, can we take some of these out of here? Like, I saw myself this morning. I don't need to see this again. It was like, I'd fucking open a drawer and there'd be like a hand mirror in it.
Always hairbrushes and mirrors.
What is happening here? But that meeting was might be the craziest meeting I'd ever been to.
What did James say to you to convince you to go back, or what changed your mind?
Baby, let me talk to Doc. You know, we're going to talk to him. We're going to see what's going on. Because this is fucked up. Babe, listen, here, I'm going to tell you something. You want out, you're out. But I'm going to tell you something. Let me talk to Doc. Let me straighten this.
And then in a full show of support, John, I then left the network probably about 6 weeks later.
Well, Doug reassures me that, like, you know, look, it's a bumpy transition. They're all used to this one thing. Everybody's on board with what you would like to do. It's all going to be fine. You have my word. And then 6 weeks later, he goes, I'm leaving for Fox. Like, what?
Let the record show that Jon Stewart debuted on Comedy Central January 11th, 1999, which was my first day at Fox. Ironically, coincidentally, I lasted 15 months. Jon lasted 16 years. So, you know.
So with Doug not there, and you know, you got to understand, like, I worked with Doug like my whole career in television. Like Doug, Eileen, like those are the people, Judy McGrath, that I knew and trusted. And not that the new people were, they were lovely. Mm-hmm. But the first 2 years of The Daily Show was like a Roman Colosseum. Like it was just a bloodbath. I mean, it was fucking awful. It truly was fucking awful. Like the kind of awful that your wife finds you in the living room at 4 a.m. just smoking cigarettes and muttering on a couch. Like it was that kind of like just the opposite of anything that I wanted to be party to. It was rough.
So when did it click?
But,
oh, sorry, go ahead.
No. When you started getting people in there who believed in the vision. Because what I realized was they viewed it as almost an insult. That, I mean, look, they'd created something really successful, you know, they'd done great with it. And there, here's this fucking guy walking in and being like, let's do something. And so that naturally creates, you know, an antagonistic work relation. Like, and I can see it, you know, them being like, who the fuck are you to come in here and do that? But my perspective of it was like, oh, I'm, in fact, we had, I think there was another crazy meeting like 3 months later where I finally, I think what happened was the writers called me in to a meeting to tell me I wasn't allowed to change their jokes anymore. And that was our, it became notorious. It was known as like the fuck you meeting. And it was a notorious, it was one of those where I finally just go like, I'm just going to let you guys in on something. You work for me. I don't work for you. And so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to let everybody in this room out of their contract. You're done. You don't have to be here anymore. Because I think before I got there, everybody had negotiated like a whole year because they were worried about continuity. I said, you'll get paid, but you no longer have to be here. But if you come back, you come back with a different mindset of like, and you know, it didn't really change that much. But once those contracts expired and we brought people in that had, I think, less animosity, it made it. And again, I don't like, look, this was their house.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, it was. Then it became your house. They didn't quite figure that out.
They didn't want the new tenant. I remember one of the producers leaving said to me, it encapsulated the entirety of like the first pain of the 2 years. One of the producers, I could tell how uncomfortable Doug is.
No, great.
One of the producers were at, first of all, every party there ended in tears. Like they had like parties every 3 weeks and every one of them ended in tears. And Doug will tell, like, that's just not my scene. Like, it's fine.
There's a lot of emotion.
So there's a lot of emotion. So a guy comes up to me at his party that he's leaving. And like, they used to do these roasts. And like at one of the roasts, one of the producers said to him, like, cause he was, I think, married to one of the correspondents, like, I get a hard on whenever I think of your wife. And then like the whole fucking atmosphere there was like, no boundaries, no rules, no, it's like, it was fucking cool.
Did you come to the night I got roasted? Because when, yes. me, Kilbourne, and Brian Unger, you know, we're all roasted at the same time because we're all leaving at the same time.
Yes.
It was brutal.
Brutal. Like not, like not funny. Just like, here's my first joke.
Ray James.
I fucking hate you and you suck and you're a sellout prick motherfucker. Good riddance. And I'm like, that had the rhythm of comedy. Like the meanest people I've ever seen in my life.
Ray James, the great Ray James.
Wild. So the producer comes up to me afterwards and he goes, as I'm leaving here, I just want to say one thing to you. And I go, what? And he goes, don't kill my baby. And it was that moment where I was like, okay, I think I get it now. These people don't know the difference between work and family. Mm. And so it was like having... Every day at work making the show was like Thanksgiving dinner with people you didn't get along with, like your relatives. And it had that depth of anger and emotion and conflict all wrapped into one. And it was...
That's a great analogy, by the way. I never thought of it that way, but I think that's exactly spot on. That is how they looked at the show.
But that's, and that ultimately is what happened. And it was one of those things. Look, and by the way, sometimes those environments, you get great shit and people thrive in it and all that. It just wasn't the environment that I could survive in. And unfortunately, as I would say to them, like, unfortunately, like, this is, you work for me. Like, that is just how it is. And like, ultimately, I can design a situation where like, you could feel hurt, but I can never design a situation where like, it's not a democracy.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And if this environment, if a more stable environment, like I was very clear and like, we're not going to be here till midnight every night. Like, that's just not how this shit's going to go. And we're going to come up with a system to make this doable. Mm-hmm. And it was just, I think it, you know what it might have been? It was like the first years of SNL. Like, it was a chaos agent,
right,
that show.
Right.
And that's how they dug it.
Right. And then they turned it to a really well-oiled machine over the years.
I think that was the real kind of difficulties. And it was painful.
Wow.
And truly, truly painful. I'm sure also to the people who were there, mm-hmm, who had this person just walk in there and turn the place completely fucking upside down to what they had been accustomed to and what they had thought they maybe had signed up for.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I always felt that I wish there would have been like a better understanding between all of us for that kind of shit.
I mean, I clearly was not there, but it seems like the staff wasn't prepared for the fact that you were going to be in charge. And I don't know how to prepare someone for that.
Or change things. Well, so it's funny. That's what informed me when Trevor was taking over, is I spent that time trying to create a situation that would make sure that what we had all been through for those first 2 years back in the day would not be repeated,
right,
because it wasn't fair to them and it wasn't fair.
You did a great job setting the staff up for that. And Trevor, too. That being said, they, you know, that was a difficult transition too. You know, change is hard, you know?
Change is very hard. And especially when you have stakeholders who were part of, you know, one of the biggest things that I would say before Trevor took over was, so I want you to look at this like the Daily Show is done. What we did over those 16 years is what we did, 17 years, whatever. You're starting a new show. And the one thing I hope you never, you know, have pop up in your mind when you're dealing with Trevor is, that's not how we do, right, things. Go into this with the idea that this is an opportunity to take this incredibly talented individual you got coming into this building and create something new. It'll probably have the bones and some things of a structure that you'll recognize, but you just completed something that I hope you're really proud of and that I hope you feel like, you know, you contributed to. But now you've got an opportunity to adapt, to change, to do something different with a new person that could be incredibly exciting. And think of all the shit you're going to learn, but don't hang on to the resentments of past. You know, those shows create circadian rhythms. They pattern you. And so your day is very regimented just so you can get things done. And if you cling to that, well, at 10 o'clock, actually, we have this meeting.
Right.
That was a different show. Mm-hmm. And I think that was what I didn't understand walking into the building in 1999 was, they're not fighting me. They believe in their creative enterprise and they think it's the same enterprise. They think I'm tricking out whatever the car is, and they like this car. They like the way it drives. And so it was a misunderstanding of purpose.
Yeah.
Not everybody,
right,
but for a lot of people. And the other side of it is like, they didn't know whether or not I was going to be driving them off a cliff.
Right.
But in my mind, I had very much been of the mindset of like, this is the one that I'm going to be myself,
right,
that I'm going to put myself into, mm-hmm, and I'm going to, and let's design that in that regard.
All right. So there you go. Part one of John Stewart, and boy, those, those first painful days of The Daily Show are clearly still very, very clear to him.
I feel like I worked there after listening to John talk about it.
He took us inside and behind the scenes. And, you know, I remember some of those instances before, you know, I actually had left Comedy Central right before he started. But yeah, I mean, it was a tough transition, moving into that seat and kind of taking over the show and getting, as he said, everybody rowing in the same direction.
Mm-hmm. I mean, as the outsider in the room here, and our listeners who listened to all of our episodes will know, we had Liz Winstead and Madeline Smithberg on very recently, who created The Daily Show. And I think Liz was gone by the time John got there, but Madeline was still there.
That's
please
right.
Correct me if I've got that wrong.
That's correct.
And it's just been really interesting to me to hear kind of both sides of that conversation about how that transition occurred and how people felt. And I just, you know, not to be wishy-washy, but I can see from both sides why it would have been painful.
Yeah, and it was really painful for him, and you know, for a period of time until they sort of found their way. The interesting thing that he said that stuck with me was in talking about the old Jon Stewart show on MTV. He said, even though it was his show and his name was on it, he said, I was doing a show for MTV, and I was trying to fit into MTV and not necessarily be himself 100%. And he made that decision with The Daily Show to do the show that he wanted to do.
You know, and that kind of ties in with something that you and I have talked about a lot on here, which is the idea that cable brands have sort of ceased to exist in the same way that they did. The positive side of that for people like John is that you could come in and create your brand within the platform of another brand, which I think probably when he was on MTV, at least at that time, it would have been really hard to do that.
Well, yeah, and MTV, you know, we, for a long time, we didn't want anything to be bigger than the brand. And that's why right. The VJs were, you know, sort of, for lack of a better term, generic. The you know, the brand, the star of the show was MTV. And while Comedy Central had a great brand, there's no question during the heyday of The Daily Show, Jon Stewart's brand, you know, shone pretty bright and may have, in fact, been bigger.
Yeah. I mean, I think some people turn on a show to watch the show. It doesn't matter who's there. And I think after Jon took over, people liked The Daily Show, but they were turning on to see what John had to say every night.
No question.
And for me specifically, and I'm sure maybe for others, like during the George W. Bush years, I could not have survived without listening to John talk about it every night because it was
must see TV.
Absolutely, it kept me mildly sane. Right. I would say.
Well, speaking of, you know, listening to what Jon Stewart has to say, we hope you'll join us next week for part two of our conversation with Jon Stewart, and we'll see you then. Thanks.
Basic is a Pantheon Media production in partnership with SiriusXM.
Hosted by Jen Chaney
and Doug Herzog.
Produced by Christian Swain and Peter Ferrioli.
Lindley Ehrlich is our assistant producer.
Sound design and music by Jerry Danielson.
Mixed and mastered by Brian Slusher.
Recorded and edited by Zach Spisner.
You can find Basic on Apple Podcasts, the SiriusXM app, Pandora, Stitcher, or wherever you like to listen. If you like the show, please rate, review, and share so other people can find us.
Don't forget to follow the show so you never miss an episode.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.